Appreciate the presence of each of you. We have a lot of material to cover tonight. Not that we haven't every time we've met, but this is quite a bit longer than we usually have. In terms of the page count I've got, it's almost as much as the page count Bob has in the book. How you succeed in that, I don't know. Given that I was, one, summarizing what he had, and then, secondly, putting in comments, which I thought would be brief. So this is going to be a lot like Bob, but then in places it's not going to be, due to the comments I've got. This is a continuation of Moses' speech on the plains of Moab. We're looking at the book of Deuteronomy. We started that in the last class. There are three sections here. On the book of Deuteronomy, this is part two. When we were going through the last class in part one, we were dealing with some themes to beware lest they forget to obey God. Beginning in that material was a second theme that we really want to pick up on, and that's the source of where we're going with this class. And that is the review of the law which Moses set before Israel. Most of these laws we look at deal with how people are to live together. And as you listen to the comments that are made, think on that point. We're addressing how people live together, how they are to treat one another in the land. Even so, these laws and what they provide is because the people have a unique relationship with God. Moses never fails to continue to remind the people of the great importance of keeping God's laws. If to you in this class this seems repetitive, keep in mind that Moses had a great lesson that he was trying to get across to the people. He was trying to make some points to them that they could remember and carry with them into the land. And we want to stay focused on what Moses was emphasizing, the point he was trying to make as he went through these laws. This section begins with about, really, we have 52 different laws discussed here with several little amplifications to each of these in many cases. Some cases you will see that if you were comparing this to Bob's lesson book, I didn't change it hardly at all. He was very brief and I couldn't be briefer and I didn't have room to say more. But in other places, like I said, you will see I've had something more to say. On the Ten Commandments, Moses repeats them here as he did in Exodus 20, but we have something unique to this, review of the Sabbath day, and that is he gives a reason for why the Sabbath day was given. That is, the people had been slaves in Egypt, and they had had no rights to a day of rest at any time until God gave them one. They were to remember the Sabbath as a blessing to them from God. It had come from God. The Sabbath was a direct result of God freeing them from slavery. And at this point, can you imagine living most of your life, those of you who have secular jobs, going to work every day? You might not even have the good fortune of having an 8-hour day. You might work from sunrise to sunset, maybe before sunrise until after sunset, and do that every day, 7 days a week. How burdensome your life would be. It would have very little pleasure in it. It would have very little time for reflection and thinking. It would be very hard to even find a way to live and worship God in those circumstances. Perhaps explains the account we have in Acts 20 of the people coming together upon the first day of the week to break bread, and by all appearances they met in the evening. But anyway, life as a slave, life as a servant was very hard, and this has to be seen as a great blessing. Question we have, based on the reason given, is if we are not Israelites and have never been slaves in Egypt, is the Sabbath to be observed by us today? That's a rhetorical question. Commandment number two has to do with the people going into the land and intermarrying. We covered some of this last week. But he says, destroy the people and their idols that you find in the land. And this command was a strong reminder that the Israelites are to destroy all the people and all signs of their idols in the land, lest they be tempted to turn aside to follow these idols and become servants to them, to worship them. This next command is to offer sacrifices only in the place God specifies. Did you get a lesson, Jeff? Okay. We're on page one, item number three. offer sacrifices only in the place God specifies. He wants them to destroy all the places of worship where the people of the land before them had worshiped idols. He wanted them to break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, burn their Asherah poles. We mentioned that last week. And wipe out their names, that is, of the idols themselves, or anything related to those idols, from all their places. He wanted every reminder removed from the land in which they were going. Do not worship Jehovah after their way. That's a great temptation sometimes. People say, well, I worship God my way. You worship God your way. God has one way to be worshiped. And he is setting that here. He has a way he has prescribed. And he wants them to worship him according to his way and not after the way of worshiping idols or in the manner of worship in their place of worship. And it was to be that sometimes those idol worship places might be more convenient, and that would be a great temptation to them to go there to worship God. So this is a very strong reminder. God's going to choose a place where his name would be, and there they were to go worship him and not fall into this repetitive pattern of worshiping where the idols were. You must worship Jehovah in the place where he puts his name. There you will take your sacrifices, your first fruits, and your vows to offer them before Jehovah. There you will eat before Jehovah and rejoice in the blessings he has given you. Comment that Bob makes, and I've elaborated on it a little bit, is in the stories later on about the divided kingdom. We do find instances where high places of idol worship were chosen by the people, possibly as a convenience for them at first. But this was done in violation of God's command, and soon worship would deteriorate into idol worship, and of the worst sort. Can we see that such commands as these were from God's wisdom and forethought, and always for their spiritual well-being? I want to put something in here. In previous classes on material like this, I have had a copy from about 4 or 5 pages from Halley's Bible Handbook. I don't know whether any of you have that in your home file. There's a chapter that's devoted to why God judged these people as he did. And Halley has a good bit of archaeological material. One that just stands out in my mind is that in many of the idol places of worship, we've often heard of them sacrificing their children in fire. They have excavated and under the floors of some of those temples, sort of like a subfloor, found as many as 1,000 jars of babies that were dedicated to in the name of those gods. Those babies were given in idol worship. Homes were built in that land, and when the home was built, it was dedicated to the name of the idol, and a cornerstone was hollowed out, and a jar was in there with a baby in it to dedicate the home. Is it any wonder that God determined judgment against those people, that they were no longer worthy to live in the land? Keep that in mind. If you get a chance to get that material, that's a worthy section to read to get some background on why this judgment came down as it did. And God said they didn't have a right to the land, and he had a right to give it to whomsoever he would. There is, in this, he told them to bring their food to the place, and he says, however, that this prohibition did not apply for game that they killed in the land to eat. This meat could be eaten where they were. On the other hand, if an animal is vowed to give to the Lord, it must be taken to the tabernacle to be offered. Fourth command, an idolater of the people must be put to death. Prophet who attempts to give you a message from a false god, even if it happens to come true, he's to be put to death. And you might say, how could a false prophet say something that might come true? I remember one time when a Mormon came to my house, I told him, I said, I'm not a Mormon, not a prophet, but I tell you that the Mormons will allow black people to be in their worship and become a part of their assembly. And that was due to the civil rights pressure being put upon them in the 70s, and sure enough, they did. I could see that coming based on the way they were and the way they caved in to political pressure. Even so, a false prophet may sometimes read the signs of the times pretty well and make a statement and it come true. But just because it came true, since it was given in the name of a false god, he was to be put to death. He says, in the second point under item 4, your nearest relative, if they become an idolater, even if it's your brother, your child, or your wife, or your dearest friend, suggest you turn to idols, do not yield to their suggestion. And putting them to death, you must not extend mercy because of who they are to you. You must put to death so others will learn of it and be afraid to turn away from God. The city that turns to idols, sometimes an entire city might do this. Destroy it, he says, all the people and the livestock. Pile the spoils of the city in the middle of it and burn it. The city shall remain a ruin and must not be rebuilt. You are a holy people. You must not pollute yourselves. You are chosen as God's holy people from all the other peoples of the earth. Therefore, he has cause to expect you to be different. You are to be clean and holy before the Lord. Do not mar yourself by cutting yourself. Do not shave your heads for the dead. And when we cover the similar passage in Numbers, you may remember he also said, do not put tattoos on yourself. Do not eat unclean animals, whether you found them in the wild or you raised them yourself. Unclean fish or unclean insects or something you find already dead. You will not give it to the stranger or sell it to the alien. When I read that, I thought of when I was growing up and we found possums on the side of the road and took them into certain sections of town and sold them to people. People did that. Hate to say it, but I could not help but think that the Israelites were forbidden to do that. Give your tithes to the Lord, he says. Tithe the tenth of all that your fields produce each year. Take your tithe to the place he chooses to put his name and to eat it before the Lord there. If the distance is too long or too great to transport all these things and the place of his name to the place of his name, you may exchange your tithe goods for money and go to the place and there redeem that money for things that are suitable to eat before the Lord and representing your tithe. You and your household eat and rejoice there before the Lord. Every third year, bring your tithe for the year and store it up in your town as food for the Levites. It can be shared with the foreigner living among you and with the widow and the fatherless so they can have sufficient and that God will continue to bless you in all your endeavors. Every seventh year, cancel all debts to your fellow Israelites, your brethren. You may collect debts from strangers. This will prevent poverty among the people of Israel. Your land was a gift from God and he will bless you in it if you fully obey him. If you serve him, then you will lend. This is a prophecy of the prosperity that they could have if they were faithful. You will lend to many nations and borrow from none. I inserted a note here because I think this is worthy. Nowhere in this is there any authority or a hint even suggested that God provided the Israelites the right to use or mistreat Gentile borrowers or strangers. We have sometimes, and I have seen it, where Jewish people even today feel that whatever they can do to take advantage of a Gentile is all right. That's not permitted by this language here. To the poor among you and needing help, then loan to them freely. Beware to act no differently as you see the seventh year approaching. If you refuse help and the poor appeal to God, then he will hold you guilty of sin. There will always be poor among you. I believe somebody else said that in the New Testament. Open your hearts, give freely. Note this again. Is not a provision or a pattern to establish a kind of socialistic equality that all share till all have the same means and resources. It provides for equality in this one unique sense, that they all have a freedom from want for the basic needs of life. It provided help for those in need and needing to borrow. This did not provide cover for those who said they were in need or for all who just wanted to borrow. Case should be that fellow Hebrews had sold himself as a slave to you, that he is to serve 6 years and the seventh year go free, unless he asks to stay with you. If he is to go free, then when he leaves, you are to supply him generously from your means, and by that your livestock, grain, and wine press, give him adequate supplies of all of those. Don't forget you were once a slave people and the Lord redeemed you. This is why I had given you this command, he said. Do not consider it a hardship to free your slave, because he has been of greater value to you than a hired hand. The Lord will bless you in this. Setting apart the firstlings of your herds and flocks, Set apart the male firstborn of your animals. Eat it before the Lord in the place he chooses to put his name. If the animal is defective or blemished, do not take it as a sacrifice to God, but eat it in your hometown. Eat the flesh, but not the blood. Pour it on the ground as you would water. And in many idolatrous worships, blood was actually consumed as part of the ritual. So God is making sure they don't do that. Observe your feast days. He mentions the Passover, which we've covered before. He says it is to remind you of the night God brought you out of Egypt. I call to your attention that in the provision of that command to carry it out, they were to partake of it at night in the evening. Keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Remember, you left Egypt in haste. Feast of Weeks. Thought it was interesting here that they were to give a freewill offering according to how he has blessed them. Reminds you of something else in the New Testament, doesn't it? Feast of Tabernacles, at the end of your harvest, rejoice, for the Lord will bless your harvest. Three times a year, all your men must appear before the Lord to keep the appointed feast. Do not come empty-handed. Give a freewill offering in proportion to the way the Lord has blessed you. So the New Testament commands to Christians did not come as something strange to the Jews who had become Christians based on this, as far as giving. Moses said, judges and officials are to be appointed when you come into the land, and every tribe and town. And I take from this, by the way, that in the appointing, he is telling them that in the towns and in the tribes, they will do the choosing of those people. So this becomes not only a standard for picking the people who would be their judges, but also, might say, the qualification for carrying out the office to do it in a manner that's acceptable to God. They should choose people who judge fairly, but then the judge should judge fairly, is the point I'm making. He must not take bribes. He must not show favor or partiality or pervert judgment in any way. Failure to establish and maintain God's standard of fair and impartial judgment for all, not just some, was a condition for loss of the land. Allowing a corrupt judicial system to flourish was evidence for disinheritance. Stone anyone that turns to idols. You may remember that earlier we had covered the fact they were to be put to death, but didn't say how. Here he tells how. They're to be stoned. Stone anyone that turns to idols. Do not set up any idol beside an altar to Jehovah. Not enough to do right. You must also not do what is wrong. I gather that from this. While worshiping of Jehovah, you must not mix in what is wrong. God hates this. One man or woman turns aside to idols and you learn of it, then investigate it carefully to see if it's true. On the testimony of two or more witnesses, stone that person to death. Witnesses will be the first in stoning, then the people. You must purge evil from among you. Notice in this provision that it avoids a rush to judgment and establishes a fair judicial process before exercising the death penalty. It requires careful examination, verify the truth of the matter, and at the mouth of two or more witnesses. This would discourage any action based on rumor, suspicion only, or the self-serving interest of one person with a bad motive. Difficult cases of judgment. If a matter arises that is difficult to judge, bring it to the priest. The priest's verdict is final. You must abide by it. Act according to the law. The priests teach you. Abide by their verdicts. One who acts or shows contempt. I thought this was interesting. Showing contempt for the verdict of the judges or the priest, that person must be put to death. Purge out this evil from the land. So all the people will hear and be afraid and not be contemptuous again. This makes one recall the saying that we hear sometimes, contempt breeds contempt. Clearly God recognized that here. He said such was evil to allow it to exist. And I make this comment that no community, whether it's the home community, involving the family, civil community, military, business, or church, will ever prosper where there's a disrespect or a contempt for law. Instructions for kings is taken from Deuteronomy 17. This is a passage you need to remember. God said, when you come into the land and say, and notice I underline something, when you say, I will set a king over me, like the other nations then, you will set up the one God chooses, an Israelite and not a foreigner. We used to have that in our Constitution. I think it still applies. We'll see. He must not multiply horses. He must not multiply wives for himself, lest they turn his heart away. He must not multiply greatly for himself silver and gold. When he sits on his throne, he must have a copy. And I take this to mean a copy that is his own, of this law written in a book. His copy shall be copied from that which is with the priests and Levites. Seems to me he's saying here, the king can't have a different version of the law. It has to show traceability to what the law is that the Levites use. It must be authentic and therefore trustworthy. He must read the law all his days so that he may learn to fear Jehovah. He may prolong the days of his kingdom. He may prolong the days of he and his children. Remember this text when you get to the study of the United Kingdom and the days of Solomon. Page 5, offerings for priests and Levites. Priests and Levites among you did not receive an inheritance, God said. Be sure to give them their proper portions that are due them out of the sacrifices and first fruits of harvest and the shearing of your animals. If a Levite moves from the town where he lives to serve in the place where God will put his name, then he may fully share in the work. I find this interesting. You're an outsider. You can't participate in this work. God says that's not the way it's going to be. He's going to be permitted to fully share in the work. But he's also going to fully share in the offerings that the people bring for the Levites, even if he has received money from the sale of family possessions. Do not engage in detestable practices by copying the practices of the nations before you. Do not sacrifice your child by fire. Do not practice any kind of sorcery, witchcraft, or anything else for which the Lord is driving out the nations. Another well-known passage, and I wish we had time to read it. We're just going to summarize it. God will raise up a prophet. God says, nations around you practice divination, but he does not permit this. Instead, he will raise up a prophet among you, and he will be the one you must hear. God will put his words in his mouth. He will tell you God's message. You are each responsible to hear the message of the prophet. Any prophet who presumes to speak when God has not spoken to him, and by the way, I think I've made this comment before, in conversations with Jewish friends, they have contended this may be the primary reason, meaning of the commandment, to not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. If a prophet presumes to speak in the name of the Lord when the Lord has not spoken, he has spoken in vain in the name of the Lord. So taking his name in vain. And so they consider that to possibly be the primary meaning of that. I'll just leave that with you to think about. He is the one you must hear, he says. You are responsible to hear his message. If you wonder about him, see if his prophesying comes true. If not, then do not be afraid of him. He has spoken by presumption. And this is a note that Bob had in the lesson book throughout the Old Testament. Many prophets of God would bring the word of God to the people. They were expected to heed, rejecting all false prophets. In the New Testament, the inspired writers applied this ultimately to Jesus, Acts 3 and verse 22, as being the ultimate fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18. Relative to cities of refuge, God says, now that you're going into the land, you must set them aside. Note this, build roads to them to assure convenient and speedy access to them for the accidental manslayer, so that the avenger of blood does not overtake him. I want to bring out this point. Does this not suggest to you that, in principle, a judicial system, right of due process, should be equally and fairly accessible to all while one's appeals are being pursued? Suggest that to me. Boundary markers. Do not move the markers that define the borders of your inheritances. Witnesses. This is a very important passage. Crimes commission must be proven or established at the mouth of two or more witnesses. Note, these are witnesses to the act, not witnesses to an accusation. And I bring to your attention Matthew 18:15-16. Oftentimes when churches have to deal with matters where one brother has an issue with another, someone says, I made a charge against someone and I bring two or three witnesses to hear that charge. That's not the way Jesus used that passage. You can't prove anything with witnesses to the charge. You have to have witnesses to the act. That's the point here. At the mouth of two or three witnesses, it's always been the way it was. It's quoted the same way in Hebrews. the witness is found to be false after careful examination or investigation, then he is to be punished, even as the accused. You must purge this evil of a false witness from among you. Show no pity. It must be an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. In other words, the same penalty that would have happened if the witness had been speaking the truth. Rules for going to war. When an enemy is larger and stronger, do not be afraid. The Lord goes with you. The priest shall address the army that is to go forth to encourage them. Jehovah gives the victory. Soldier has a new house, a new vineyard, or has pledged but not yet married, then stay home from this war. That doesn't mean you can't go to subsequent wars. If a soldier is afraid, then stay home, lest others become afraid. If your army approaches a city that is a distance from you, and by context he's talking about a city not in the land of Canaan, then offer them peace. If they accept, then make them servants to forced labor. You may remember that David did that to some he put to serious forced labor. They refuse and engage you in battle, then lay siege to the city. When the Lord delivers such a city, Moses has provided details on how to treat that city. They are different than the way they would treat the cities of the nations nearby, that is within Canaan, and we're going to talk to that next. If the city is a Canaanite city in the land of promise, this is the rule. Destroy the city, lest they teach you to follow in their detestable ways and sin. Why did God make a difference? The reason is God judged the Canaanite cities. He had not judged the cities and the nations surrounding Canaan as severely. Save fruit-bearing trees in or near a siege city. Use the non-fruit-bearing trees for your siege works. Gary Fisher speaking on a lesson on that when he was here last time. The unsolved murder. A murdered man found, and the murderer is unknown. Then the death must be acknowledged. In other words, you can't just ignore it and not look into it and follow up on it, because the shed blood cries out from the ground. He says an atonement, as described in the passage, is to be made to purge the guilt of the shedding of innocent blood. You're not in position to punish the murderer, but you still must make atone for that, and this is how he's provided for it. Marrying a captive woman. Certain procedures are to be followed for the case where a soldier chooses a captive woman to marry as his wife. She must submit to certain ceremonial rituals and rules for cleanness. It involves the shaving of her head, the paring of her nails, the setting aside of her native raiment or garments, and she is to observe a period of mourning for her family. If she later displeases her husband, God has a rule here. She must be set free wherever she chooses. He must not sell her or treat her as a slave. Right of the firstborn if a man has more than one wife. If the firstborn is the child of a lesser loved wife, he will still receive, that is, the child will receive the double portion of his birthright. The husband cannot withhold to give to the firstborn of the wife he loved most. The rebellious child. The rebellious son must be stoned to death. You must purge evil from among yourselves. All should hear and be afraid. Bury the criminal. That is very interesting to me. I suppose I've never heard of a society that was so careful to have so much civility. But civility is enjoined. The criminal's body is not to be left on the tree overnight. It must be buried. The criminal is under the curse of Jehovah. Neighbor's possessions tells us that finders, keepers, losers, weepers doesn't apply here. He says, if possessions are found, return them to their owner. If the owner is unknown, then keep them until the owner is found and then return. If you come upon an animal of your neighbor that is trapped, then help it. And I can well remember growing up in farm country finding goats and cows and pigs trapped in fences, and you either got them out or you went and got some help or you told somebody so you could get it out. You just didn't ignore it and let it die. Inappropriate conduct. Sexes must not wear clothes of the opposite sex. Jehovah detests this. Comment here is this may refer to transvestites and the practice of that in their society. Business of the sexes wearing one another's clothes. Do not plant two kinds of seed in your vineyard. A vineyard is defiled. My comment here is, since you have one crop, the vineyard, this may have to do with greed, trying to get more out of the land, possibly. And it also may have to do with not allowing the land to recover or rest. You're overworking it. Remember, the land is to have a Sabbath rest. Do not plow an ox or a donkey yoke together. Why? My personal judgment, having seen animals, this would be a perverseness in the treatment of two animals such as this. They're usually of different size, different strength, different gait, and different temperament when you're directing them. Do not wear clothing of wool and linen together. And for the life of me, I can't even fathom a reason why this is the case. Some of you may have some idea, but I want to make this comment. These things were to be observed whether one understood the why of them or not. Jehovah required it, and that should be sufficient. Showing consideration for things around you. And one interesting thing is if you come upon a mother with nesting birds, don't take the mother and let the young die. Provide a barrier on your roof to keep someone from falling off and being injured. Remember, they had flat roofs. David was walking on his roof when he saw Bathsheba. Most houses were flat roofed in that land. They needed a barrier. Tassels, we've talked about those. He said, put them on the four corners of the cloak you wear. The one thing I learned out of this, I think I learned, is that he's talking here about an outer garment, not all garments. Matter of the wife suspected or accused of premarital unchastity. In other words, a man marries a woman expecting her to be a virgin, and that comes to his attention that it may not be the case, then God has provided a procedure to deal with this breach of trust to determine if the man has been wrong or if the woman has been wrongly accused. And I didn't detail this here, but you can look it up. Rules of punishment regarding adultery. If the woman is married, if the woman is betrothed and in the city, both are to be put to death. It is presumed that this was a consensual act since she could have cried out. Betrothed and outside the city, it's presumed that it was rape. Woman not betrothed, then the man is to marry her and he can never divorce her. Man cannot take to wife his father's wife. Rules regarding who can be not be part of the assembly of Israel. God said the sexually mutilated, and I give us an example, eunuchs. There may be others. The illegitimate person, the Ammonite and the Moabite, even to the 10th generation. I leave out this. What about Ruth? Edomite and Egyptian to the 3rd generation. And I'm not suggesting by my question that God's rules were ill-defined and easily violated or people got waivers. I think reasonably we could go through to show why she was an exception. Comment. This does not mean that any of these people were individually counted eternally condemned. And I'm very sensitive to this because when I was a child, my mother told me of a man who went to a denominational church back in the country days of the 20s and 30s. And he was there standing on the outside and he was an illegitimate person. He heard a preacher preaching about people who were born illegitimately. And apparently he came down with fire and brimstone on such a person and condemned him out of hand. Person went and took their life. I've never forgotten that example. And that's why I say this does not mean these people are condemned. These conditions in and of themselves did not make this person a sinner with no hope. Consider Jephthah. Was he not an illegitimate son? He was a great judge in Israel. And the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8. It would seem this is a matter of ceremonial uncleanness only. Cleanness in the camp. Keep army camps clean of filth and human waste according to the laws of cleanness. You can read them. If one becomes unclean, abide by laws for unclean persons until clean. The runaway slave. The runaway that comes to you must be given refuge. Do not return him. Do not oppress him. Let him live where he chooses. That is apparently referring to don't use forcible restraints. Do not hold him against his will if he wants to go. Temple prostitutes. God said, no Israelite, man or woman. Think about it. A man or a woman could be a temple prostitute. To serve God, God didn't allow it for him or in any idol in any way. No wages or earnings from such activity is to be given to the temple, even as a vow. this, to me, illustrates a principle that God is showing that He wants nothing from us that has been obtained in a wrongful and evil way, besides contemning this prostitution. Interest-bearing loans, do not charge your brother, fellow Hebrew, interest on a loan. You're permitted to charge interest to a stranger. Vows, pay your vows that you've made. The Lord expects it, else it becomes a sin. He says vows are not necessary. Vows to God are not necessary, but if you make them, then you best pay them. Rights in your neighbor's fields. When I grew up, we were well aware of this in the farm country. If passing through your neighbor's vineyard or grain field, then you can eat all you want. At my time, people respected this Bible provision. You cannot gather and take away. You must not bring a basket with you. Remarrying the woman a man has put away already as his wife. The husband cannot take back his former wife after putting her away by a letter of divorcement. After she is married to another, she is defiled, God says. This is the case even if her interim husband is now dead or he put her away by divorcement. Exempt from war, a man is exempt from war for 1 year after taking a new wife. Securities for a loan, do not take a means of livelihood as a security for a loan. I think this is true that even today in matters of personal bankruptcy, creditors cannot take the tools of a man's trade, the house where he lives, or the car he needs for work. Same principle involved. Do not use his situation to go to his house and choose security for your loan. Let him choose the security for the loan. If he offers you an animal as security, you don't go pick out the animal. That's the point being made. Do not keep a poor man's pledge overnight, for he must sleep in his cloak. Do not deprive a widow or orphan of justice. Do not take a widow's cloak for a pledge. Kidnapper's punishment, he shall be put to death. And I refer you to the passage in 1 Timothy 1:10, referring to men stealers. These are men who deal with traffic in men, and this certainly includes kidnapping for that purpose. So slavers were condemned by that passage as being kidnappers and men stealers. Leprosy, observe all the rules regarding leprosy. Do what the priest tells you. The guilty one only dies. The father is not to be put to death for the sins of his son or the son for the sins of his father. Hired man, do not take advantage of a hired man because he's poor, whether he is an Israelite or a stranger. Pay him his day's wages by sunset each day. He may need them. Remember what James says about the Lord of Sabaoth hearing the cries. If he cries to the Lord against you, you will be counted as a sinner. The last page, leave the last of your crops for the poor, that is grain sheaves, olive trees, and vineyards. Do not go back over them a second time. My personal thought on this, and that's just mine, this seems to refer to crops that bear their yield in a short period of time versus the crop that has an extended bearing season. Leave last for the strangers, the widow, and the fatherless. Remember, you were once slaves. Show kindness to the poor. Beatings is punishment for the guilty. If the judge requires a beating for a crime, it's to be administered immediately. Before the judge, the victim is to lie down for that beating. It should not exceed 40 stripes. Duty of a brother to his brother's widow. If a man dies without an heir, this is the law that we call the law of levirate marriage, to raise up an heir to the deceased brother's name. The brother could decline. Recall Ruth and the kinsman nearer than Boaz. There was some ostracism associated with the one who declined. Do not muzzle the ox that treads the grain. Paul quoted this in the New Testament. Woman's punishment if she seizes the private parts of a man fighting her husband. Accurate weights and measures. God viewed it dishonest to have different standards in your commerce. That, especially if those standards were to your advantage or your friends, you showed partiality. Remember the Amalekites, because they treated you, how they treated you when you were coming out of Egypt. The Lord has appointed they will be blotted out as a people. First fruits and tithes as thanksgiving offerings to God. Remember them when you come into the land. Worship, go to the place God put His name. Worship there. Rejoice in God's goodness. Remember the rules for every third year. Mutual vows between Jehovah and Israel. And this refers to His covenant. And that He plans to keep His part of it. He wants them to keep their part of it so He can bless them. And we will study that covenant more in the next lesson, Lord willing. I never thought I'd finish this. But this, as the material Bob had in the book. I did my best to cover every point. Thank you for your attention.